Well, hello, a new episode of Synchronized, and I'm here with Simon Webb, as usual. Hi, Simon, good to see you again.
Hi, Ferry, how are you?
I'm fine. Interesting day today. It's election day in the Netherlands, so we're going to see what's going to happen for the next 4 years.
Oh.
So keep our fingers crossed. We have got a very interesting guest today, I think. We have discussed a lot of issues the last couple of episodes of Synchronized. And of course, one of the major things that always came up was companies that are disrupting the ordinary music publisher's business model. And one of them, of course, is Artlist.io. And we're very lucky to have Ori Winokur here, who is head of music of Artlist. Hi, Ori.
Hi, Ferry and Simon. Very happy to be here. And hi to all our listeners.
Great. Very nice to have you, Ori.
Good to have you, Ori. We always start with a question. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're coming from, what's your background?
Of course. So I come from Israel, first of all, born and raised. I've been a musician basically all of my life. I started out playing the saxophone, actually, and then bass and guitar. And I studied music in high school and spent most of my high school years in bands, basically, in Jerusalem, in Israel. And then, to keep it kind of short, I ended up becoming a sound engineer and then a music producer. I produced many, many records for a lot of Israeli, mainly indie Israeli artists. Some of them were very also internationally acclaimed, like Asaf Avidan, which I'm pretty sure you guys know over there in the Netherlands as well. Mm-hmm. And then I basically had a very long music production career for, I guess, over 10 years. I also established a very successful studio in Tel Aviv that was live and kicking for about 7 years. And about 2.5 or 3 years ago, Artlist approached me, basically. Artlist was established already 5 years ago, and I joined about 3 years ago. And basically, I started off, I'm in the new head of music. For the last 2 years, I was the head of Artlist Original, which is basically the original music department of the company, which I basically established in the past 2 years. It wasn't totally existing before I came in. It was why they approached me, and I established a very big operation to produce original music for the platform. I think it's very similar to how Netflix has Netflix Originals. So after Artlist had the platform, they understood they should also have an original division. And I'm very proud to say we established an incredible infrastructure. We create almost 1,000 songs every year now in all styles of music. And we also set up a music distribution system and a publisher. So we were like a very active, I would say like a modern record label in a way as well. And basically it's pretty new news. About a month ago, I was promoted to be head of music. So I'm in charge of all the music operations of the company, which is very exciting and interesting. And Artlist in general keeps growing in all directions, so it's very interesting to be part of it.
Okay, but basically there are three departments within Artlist: Artlist Original.
In the music section, the whole company is already, I think, almost 20 different departments. But in the music, we have four departments. We have the original division. We have what we call external A&R, where we sign artists that have existing catalogs that want to join the Artlist catalog. We have an audio department doing all the audio work for the company, mixing and mastering and audio supervision and all the development stuff that involves sound and audio. And we have the media team, which does all the categorization, and they basically, you know, set up the catalog and keep adjusting it for our customers on a daily and weekly basis, which is a very important part of the product.
And so, Ori, is all your offices in Israel, or do you have offices around the world at the moment?
So most of the company is based in Israel, but I think now it's really starting to expand. You know, the year of COVID kind of changed everything, so even our new employees are working remote. So we didn't open any official office outside of Israel, but we have already four different locations in Israel and a few already remote international workers. And yeah, and it keeps growing. We have partners from New York and investors, so it's definitely a very global business.
Good.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the business model behind Artlist.io?
Of course. I think you described it very well when you said we're a bit of disruptors for the music licensing industry. And it's indeed very interesting. I think when Artlist came in about 5 years ago, it was the first time it aired. It was basically the first service to offer music licensing under a subscription model. And I guess in a way, it's like the Spotify of music licensing, you know, like how the streaming age started with, you know, subscription model for listening to music. So I think Artlist, the business model is very simple. You make a yearly subscription. It costs $200 a year, and you can use any song in the catalog for video as a soundtrack, and also to any kind of video, any kind of broadcasting, any kind of use. And I think
also commercials.
Yeah, absolutely. Any kind of video is available through the license. Of course, I mean, the majority of our customers are all online YouTubers, TikTokers, of course, but we also have a lot of, you know, big commercial companies, a lot of brands using our music all the time, a lot of celebrities, also a lot of the film industry, movie industry, TV industry. I guess in a way, it really approaches the new age of creators, though. You know, I think the bigger companies come because of the quality, which is very cool and makes us very happy. But the majority of our customers are online new age content creators, I think you can say. And the business model was there for them, you know, was invented for them.
So, Ori, tell us how you work with your creators. Are they artists or writers, or how does that work?
You mean the music creators?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. So we have, as we said before, we have two different models of how musicians can add music to the catalog or can take part of this interesting thing. So when it comes to the original work, it's basically, it operates like a production house or music label where we sign, we have already a very big roster of over 200 artists worldwide, and they create basically on demand, kind of. Not kind of, it's on demand, but it's also very free spirit creativity. And there we basically pay an upfront fee for every artist collaborating. We're, you know, it's very important for us to respect every artist and every creator. So we pay a fee, and then we also distribute the music also outside of Artlist. And we also have like a revenue split, which is basically 50-50 between the company and the artists themselves. And I think it's like a combination of all kinds of music models that used to exist in the music industry. And I think it's a very interesting model for these days. And on the other side, we have the A&R department, where we kind of it's more like sub-licensing, or we represent tracks for external artists, and we pay them a royalty per use, very, very similar to how Spotify pays for streams. So every time an external song is downloaded from the platform, we pay a royalty per download. And it ends up, I can't really give numbers, but musicians on Artlist make amazing amounts of money every year. And we're actually just transferring to monthly payments as well, which is also very cool. And we provide full data for everybody about everything. You know, we're trying to be very open and very fair towards our artists. You know, I see it as an integral part of the success in any way you can think of.
Interesting thing for me is, I'm coming from an old school music publishing background. You're talking about artists. We're always talking about composers. Mm-hmm. Are those the same to you, or are those different?
I guess it's just a kind of a broader definition. I say artist, and for us it's everything. It could be composers, performers, writers of lyrics. It could be producers. We work with a lot of producers, on the original especially. And every production is different. Like, we work with different collaborators, so we call them all artists, you know. And I think they all are artists, basically.
It's a container thing for
yeah.
you. Container
yeah.
name.
Yeah.
So, Ori, when you Google Artlist.io, it says royalty free. Mm-hmm. So, Is it royalty-free? I mean, is there no royalties at the PRS, the PRO end of things?
No, so the thing is, I mean, royalty-free is actually a very, very confusing term. Most people get confused when they read it. The term royalty-free basically only means one thing, to keep it simple. It means that you get the license once and it covers you basically forever for the use of the music. However, when you broadcast it, it could create more royalty collection depending on the actual broadcasting, but it's a one-time royalty fee for the person that wants to use the music. So it's a bit complicated. It's not, I mean, royalty free doesn't mean there's no royalties or that it's free. It just means that it's, you know, it's not per use or per, because it used to be that a music license would be, let's say, I want to use this song for a specific commercial, for specific territory, for a specific length of time or period of time. And we give one license that can you can use it however you want, how many times you want, on whatever kind of video you want. And you can broadcast it wherever you want. But it doesn't mean there's no royalty collection happening on the back end, because when companies broadcast it, even YouTube, they need to pay performance royalties, and today actually also mechanical royalties. And it's actually the whole digital age is really changing also, because a lot of legislation also in Europe and the US is changing around these platforms. And actually, as we speak, you know, Article 17 in Europe is changing the way platforms can broadcast content. So platforms are going to start paying royalties for broadcasting the content, not for using it. So
if I'm an artist and my album is on artlist.io, people pay a yearly subscription, then mm-hmm. they can use my music in television shows, in corporate videos, in commercials.
Absolutely.
And when it's aired on, for example, the BBC, mm-hmm. The writers will get back-end money from
Absolutely.
Performance.
Right? Yeah, if the societies do their work properly, then yes.
So does that mean that you're also a publisher, or you're not a publisher?
So we are the publisher of our original works, which is about 13% of the catalog. The rest of the catalog today is from these external artists, and then it's on their own. I mean, they're their own publishers, basically. It's mostly indie artists, of course. And it's up to them. If they register their copyrights properly and track it, they can collect more royalties for the uses, of course.
Okay. And can I ask what the split is between the artist and you on the revenues generated through your platform?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a bit of a complicated situation. Again, for the original works, we pay a fee, and then we have a split on back-end royalties and streaming royalties, because we also distribute the music. For the external artists, basically, again, very similar to the streaming platforms model, we take 30% of what is our revenue from subscriptions, and we divide it by the amount of downloads for the same period of time, and that gives us a rate per download. And then every artist gets paid by the amount of downloads they had. So I think, you know, it's very different than it used to be that music licensing was an artist that has a song would wait for a one-time sync that would pay him $20,000. And now with the new micro-licensing age and model, it's more like there's a lot of micro-uses, and it ends up being a lot of money. So that kind of sums it up, I think. It's very similar to how streams for audio, you know, like Spotify and Apple Music, how it kind of solved the what was the, you know, black hole of no payment for listening to music and no royalties for listening to music, because record stores and record sales dropped tremendously since the end of the 90s, I guess, already. And the streaming model kind of made a solution to this situation, gave a solution to it. So it's very similar, I think.
So how many tracks do you have at the moment, Ori, in your catalog?
The catalog today is almost 18,000 songs. And it's actually, it sounds maybe like a lot, but it's not. I mean, today about between 40 to 60,000 new songs are released every day on streaming platforms, on what you can say the record stores. The new age record stores. And in Artlist, actually, the whole thing is that we're big believers of curation. So we have a lot of teams listening to every submission, listening to every production, original production we do. We have very devoted teams for that, and we're definitely our main work is, you know, delivering the best content for our users and also in the best way so they can find what they're looking for their video. That's kind of the way we see it. And we're big believers of quantity over quality. So I think 5 years with 18,000 tracks, if you compare it to what's happening in the music world today, it's very, very little, basically. It's a small catalog.
Yeah. So it's interesting because you emphasize quality. And when we've talked to conventional libraries and we've asked them, how are you going to resist the disruptors? And they all go, oh, quality, our music's going to be better. And yeah. you've answered that right there, and you say, no, you're as equally concerned about quality as anybody else, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, for us, it's the main thing, and it's also the quality of everything. It's the quality of the song, of the, you know, writing of the song. It's quality of the production, of the sound and the mix quality. And it's also the quality of how we deliver it through the catalog and how the actual platform works as a tool for the video, for this new age video creator that wants to find music very fast, very easy. And that's why we have our biggest music team is the one that does all the categories and all the ratings and kind of, you know, organizes all the lists. And I think also that's why it's called Art List. That's basically what it's about. You know, it's about the right listing and the right way to deliver the content to our customers, to these creators.
So, talking about lists, how do you whitelist the tracks that people are paying the right, you know, they're paying a subscription, therefore they don't want ads on their YouTube. So you whitelist them for them, or how does that
yes,
work?
Yes, I mean, it's free for them to, they can monetize the way they want on the content platforms. That's part of the license. I mean, they're free to use it, and the video is theirs with the music inside of it, of course.
Right, okay, I understand. Yeah.
When you compare your content, your catalog, 18,000 tracks to the likes of BMG, Universal, or Warner, it's a very tiny catalog.
Of course.
So aren't you afraid that at a certain point when you give your users the chance to download unlimited amounts of tracks, that you run out of tracks?
No, because we constantly produce and sign more and more music. We release new music every day on the platform, ranging between 10 to 20 new songs every day, basically, and growing, of course. And again, it's really interesting because it's definitely not about the quantity. I think it's, you know, it's kind of a general internet problem or situation is the amounts of data and information is so huge. You know, that people can't find themselves. So if BMG has, I don't know, 100,000 songs, but it's not easy to find or it's not the right sounds for what the people are actually looking for now, it doesn't mean it's better than what we have, where it's much more precise and accurate, you know?
Ori, you're obviously quite a visionary company and you're looking to the future. So I wonder if you take conventional music business, it was disrupted and they ended up with iTunes and Spotify. I wonder whether you think in your area of the business it's going to end up with one or two key players like that, or whether there will be room for a number of players. And if it's one key player, I expect you think it's going to be Artlist. So is it going to be all about acquisition, or is it about coexistence? And just as a follow-up to that, how do you see the conventional libraries coexisting with you?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I can really, you know, give the most accurate prophecy on what's going to happen.
I'd be interested to hear what you think.
Yeah, I mean, my intuition would say the internet world or the digital age is very wide, so I definitely think there's place for a few, for sure, you know. And I think it's the winners are going to be the ones that keep developing, and we're definitely working on a lot of developments on Artlist, not just for music. We also have footage section and sound effects sections, and we acquired Motion Array, which is a video template company, and we're basically becoming more and more of like a one-stop shop for video creators. And, you know, if I'm going to answer, it's going to look a little maybe far ahead from your question, but I think it's going to... The way I see it, I think the digital world is changing and going to keep changing. And we're definitely going to see a lot more virtual reality assets and a lot, you know, things are going to change. And also the way content is consumed is going to change, and I think assets are going to change. So music would probably be even a smaller part of what is the digital asset. So, you know, the way I see it, people are going to, you know, buy digital worlds in a way, and a song could be a part of it, but it would also be graphics and video and you know, and visual, all sorts of new age visuals which we don't even really know very well, you know. So I think the companies that are going to win are the ones that are going to keep developing, you know, and understanding how people use content in new platforms and new situations. You know, just like TikTok kind of came in the past 4 or 5 years and really changed. Also changed the way content is made. You know, every little girl is a content creator today. It wasn't like that 5 years ago. So it all changes. The format changes. But I think if you look at on music history, it's always what happened. You know, it used to be only live music, right? And then there was recorded music on vinyl or very simple vinyl. And then cassettes, and then CDs, and so on. And the mediums kind of keep changing, but the companies that can adapt to the changes are always there. That being said, I mean, I'm almost also sure that the big, big major players, like you said, BMG or Universal, I mean, I can't imagine them disappearing. I also know that they're doing a lot of work to develop on more techie or high-techie directions, you know, so... Yeah, I mean,
but a major thing, of course, is the huge price difference. I mean, you've set a price point, $200 a year, unlimited usage. Mm-hmm. I don't think that any executive at Universal will go to bed thinking, "Well, that's a good idea. Let's start to doing that tomorrow." aren't you afraid that maybe a new player would come in?
I can answer.
We're going to charge $190, and it's going to be a race to the bottom.
I don't think it's going to drop much, you know, further down from where it is. But what you just said, I mean, you could say the same if you would ask a music executive 20 years ago if he would imagine, you know, to have all the music in the world available to stream and listen to for $5 a month. Nobody would believe it, right? And today they're all playing that game. They all have, all these big companies have licensing agreements with all the platforms, and everybody understands it's again, I think the mediums keeps changing, and it's just a matter if the companies know how to kind of keep going with it. You know, I mean, for me, one of the most interesting stories is the Napster story, you know, because when Napster came out, it was basically the technological infrastructure for what today the streaming world is, you know. And then the big companies kind of, you know, went against it instead of going with it. And it took 15 years for this gap to be completed. And the only thing happened there was the price deteriorated because there was a generation of music consumers that got used to not paying anything for music.
So yeah, but the big difference, of course, is that they are now part with their catalogs of Spotify. Do you think they're going to be part with their catalogs on Artlist? Is that your goal?
I'm saying that, first of all, I actually know that a lot of these big labels are looking into outlets for micro-licensing. I think like 2 or 3 years ago when I started at Artlist, it was like nobody understood what I'm talking about or what's our message in this music, in the music world, where I come from and where I met Artlist, you know. And I think in the past 2 years, I hear more and more people getting it, kind of getting the message and understanding. It's just a part of how the music ecosystem works today. And I can actually tell you the one thing that we see on Artlist Original, which is incredible, is that the songs that do well on our platform, on Artlist, gain tremendous amount of streams on Spotify and Apple Music, because these videos that are created with the music are acting kind of like natural promotion for the music, which is really incredible. I mean, we have artists gaining millions of streams with no PR, no old school kind of marketing, music marketing, you know. And in many ways, I think these video content creators, new age content creators, are like the new tastemakers or the new radio DJs of the music world. And I think that's also going to keep happening. So, you know, if you're going to have like virtual VR worlds, you're going to have people there that, you know, tastemakers inside those worlds that really make a difference on what people want to listen to. Or So it's kind of like it's becoming more and more of one big ecosystem from music, I think, the video world and the music world.
So basically you give an easy access to those tracks, and then you can generate money on Spotify and iTunes because people are using those tracks.
Yeah, using it, and then people Shazam it from the videos and get to the streaming platforms because they like the song, you know, on the video. So these videos are like kind of, you know, natural promotion for the music, which is very, very interesting. Because one download from Artlist could become 20 million views in a week for a successful video, which is something that, you know, a musician would die for 2, 3, 4 years ago, or would pay a lot of money to achieve. So it's very interesting, you know.
But does that also mean that Artlist is not really interested in instrumental music, because then you don't really have the artist feel?
That's also not true. We do a lot of instrumental music, and that also changed a lot, because a lot of people listen to instrumental music also not as background. I think what I can say here that for me was also a big surprise, you know, when I started working with Artlist, I was a kind of like an indie music producer, and I was a big believer of, you know, records and the artist and the whole music package that we're used to have. And my initial, I guess, fear, you know, going into Artlist was, am I going to do soundtrack music now, or what's going to happen, you know? And the big surprise for me was that, and that's, I think, a lot of old school musicians or people from the old school world don't really get it, that the video world changed so much, you know, because it used to be films, so you had cinematic music for films or ambient tracks or very specific songs for film or TV or some kind of commercial and ad music. That's what you used to have. But now there's so many kinds of videos, and people use music as part of their brand, part of their statement, you know. So you could have a skateboard video on YouTube with like serious trap music in the background, and you can have a classic travel video with a cinematic or even world music. Anything could go, you know. So we basically produce music and sign music of any style you can imagine. Really, it's ranging from anything to anything. It's really interesting, and everything is working. Like, people use every kind of music today for video. So it's a new world for soundtrack, you know. It's not what it used to be. And I think also people like listening to instrumental music more, because when it's on streaming, it's not like buying a record. It's like sometimes you just want a specific mood in the background when you work. So you would you have those playlists on Spotify, which is just like piano melodies, soft melodies, or whatever it is, peaceful moods, so on. So there's place for anything. I mean, I think that's kind of the magic of the age of the internet, you know?
Ori, you talked earlier about technology and how it relates to music, and you know, I would agree completely with you, and say that, you know, without the bow and arrow, you wouldn't have the violin. Without the cannon, you wouldn't have the saxophone. Without the NASA space mission, you wouldn't have the Moog synthesizer. And now, where we're at now with technology, seems to me that it's democratized completely the process of making music. So, you know, where when I started out, it was in the hands of a few people who could afford incredibly expensive equipment. Now it's all about any individual can afford to make music. And you've got that strand, so it's kind of going from the specialists down to a much more democratic, it's like talking, making music now is like talking. And you've got that strand, and then another strand is AI. So you've got these, that I would say that's where technology is at right now. It's AI and a democratic music process. So if you agree, I wonder where you think those two sort of strands are headed, and how they'll contribute to the Artlist's development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so first, it's a great observation, what you just said. And I think, again, very similar to what happened in the video world, because anybody can create video. If you think about it, you know, in the 50s, 60s, up to the 80s or 90s even, making a video was a very serious business. Like, you couldn't do it from your phone. people forget it today because everybody films video all the time and posts it all the time. But basically, it used to be a super expensive operation and production. And same with music. And I think that's the way it evolved. You know, it started from big companies making big content, expensive content, and therefore music licensing was part of that and was very expensive. And now today it's cheaper, easier, and kind of everybody can do it. And therefore also the micro licensing model is much cheaper. I'm trying to understand your question exactly. Where it's headed, I think it's very interesting because in one way you hear a lot of music that sounds totally the same. You know, you can listen some playlists on Spotify, every track sounds almost the same thing, like they use the same set of virtual instruments or plugins, and like there's a lot of the same. And then on the other hand, you see all these total breaking of conventions when it comes, even in, you know, I think everybody's talking about Billie Eilish for the past 2 years, and I think it's a very, very interesting story because her music is kind of breaking so many traditions of pop music and it's still so successful. And I think it shows you how open and how more creative everything is becoming. And while on the one hand it's becoming harder for musicians to break through because there's so much noise happening, on the other hand, you really see how real creativity is starting to really flourish again. So it's less about if you have the big label behind you and more about if you're authentic, if you're breaking the edge, cutting the edge, I mean, if you're breaking boundaries. It's more about that more than anything else, you know, and you see it in basically every music element you can think about is changing, like the form of songs, the production of songs, the way you produce music, the way you write music, everything is changing all the time. And then on the other hand, you know, you see how when you have real good music, it would also still succeed. I don't know if you've heard the last Anderson .Paak and Bruno Mars song, which is now number one worldwide. And it's basically a classic 70s, beautiful soul R&B ballad. You know, just it could have been an Al Green record from the 70s, but it's so damn good that it flows up and everybody loves it because it's great, you know.
Great vibe, yeah.
Great everything. It's a great song, great performance, great recording, and you can't resist it because it's so good, you know. But even there, you could see, I mean, if you analyze that song, for example, the form is new. Like the way they built it, it's more like a modern, year 2020 kind of song and not that old 70s song. So it's very interesting. I think where it's headed, it's very hard to say. I think there's going to be a place where, you know, I think there's going to be the next generation is going to be kind of like a little bit of cleanup because today everybody's making music and trying to break through. And I think some people are going to give up if they're not good enough, basically. And kind of like natural filtering will start happening. I actually hope it's what will happen because I think it's important. Because there is a lot of, I don't want to use any curse word, but there's a lot of bad music being released as well, which is kind of a little bit like background noise, you know, it's just too much. And again, if we talked about how Artlist is more about quality, it's part of that because there's so much noise, so much new music, it's hard to find the good stuff, you know. And I think there's going to be a lot of place for digital tastemakers from all platforms, whether it's Spotify or Apple with their playlists or content creators with a lot of followers, for example, and many, many other avenues I can think about that going to determine when music is breaking through, you know?
I've got a question for you. As I said before, we have discussed on numerous podcasts Artlist, because you're a disruptor. People think it's a race to the bottom, that the quality isn't good enough. Well, you just said, well, we spend a lot of time making sure that we get the absolute best tracks on our platform. So what would you say as an advice to the traditional publishers who would say those things?
What should they do? I would say they should open their mind because I'm going to go back to the Napster story because for me it's a great example. You know, that happened. Napster was released, I think, year 2000 or 2001, which is already, you know, over 15 years ago. And they basically brought in the technology that today is the base of what you call streaming platforms. The only thing they didn't have was the licensing models for the music, because they were pirates, basically. They didn't even intend to be pirates, you know? And then the labels came in and they sued them and tried to destroy them. They actually succeeded to destroy them. And there's actually a very, very interesting movie I recommend everybody here to watch it. It's called Downloaded, the Napster story, Downloaded. And you could actually see all the court conversations there around the story, and you have all these representatives of Sony, Universal, and Warner, and you have, you know, Napster on the other side, and there's one moment there where the judge starts yelling at the label representatives, and he tells them, you know, the cat has left the bag. It's not going back. What are you trying to do? It's not going to help you. And again, it's the same thing, and if I'm going to take you back maybe 100 years before that, when the first vinyl was released in the US, all the musician unions had a strike because they thought people are not going to go to concerts anymore. So I think, you know, there's this kind of paradigm in the music industry, and definitely for musicians, even more than the music businessmen or industry professionals. For musicians, it's always very hard to accept change, you know, because they kind of romanticize the way that the music is released. Like, I'm making a record, it's going to be released on a record. And for me, actually, even before Artlist, when I was producing, I really started to kind of throw that away. And it only became like, let's just make a great song. And if we make a great song, it's going to work. It doesn't matter how it's released. It doesn't matter if it's going to be printed. It doesn't matter if it's going to be on YouTube or on Spotify, or it's going to be on vinyl, or you're going to promote it for the radio. If it's good, it's going to get to the ears of the people that want to hear it. And I think that's where most, you know, industry professional and mostly musicians are stuck, because they're kind of romanticizing the way it used to be. And it's and you know, technology makes all the changes faster than ever. So it's not like more changes, it's even faster changes. So what we see now is probably not going to last more than 2 or 3 years from now as well. You know, something's going to change. I'm kind of sure about that as well. So
The thing, of course, is that a lot of those people are stuck, and stuck, I mean contractual stuck, in old business models, like, for example, territories, mm-hmm. Exclusivity.
Mm-hmm. Territories, for one, definitely should go absolutely out of the table, because the internet is not territory-based, you know? And actually, I think also if you look on what's happening with all the royalty collection in the world, it's still very territory-based, but it's kind of trying to cover global what's happening on the internet per territory. And also there, what you can see, I mean, what I see as the next development is making that much more centralized and global. I mean, if you ask me where I see a vision of how copyrights are going to be handled in the future, it's going to be one centralized universal, not the label, universal global centralized database for music, because everything is matchable in the digital age, and it's just a matter of matching the right, you know, right uses to the right composers, right performers, so on. And then you can also flow, streamline the money. You have cryptocurrency today. All the technologies are there to kind of change the way everything is thought about, you know. So territories for me is out the door. It doesn't matter at all. You know, you can release a song in Africa and a person in LA can listen to it the same minute you release it. There's no more territories involved. So
the other point that Ferry made was about exclusivity, and that is something that definitely is raising its head, and it totally dominates the traditional business model of music libraries. I wonder, do you are your tracks exclusive to you? And if somebody gives you a track, is that exclusive, or are they allowed to do
so again, it's a great point. We have two models. So for the originals, the tracks are exclusive, but, and there's a big but here, that we only sign exclusivity per track. So we have none of our artists are kind of tied to us in any way. They're free to do whatever they want. The actual songs are exclusive, and I think in general, again, that's more of like the modern approach. It should be global and per asset. Everything is per digital asset. You have one song, you can decide how you want to structure a deal around it. Mm-hmm. I think full exclusivity is something that's just not relevant anymore. You know, maybe, you know, when you reach a specific point in your career where you want a lot of, you know, background behind you, like financial background, then okay. But for most musicians today, it's just not a good option because you're tied. It makes you tied. Things are moving very, very fast. And I think it's kind of the new age is you want to take advantage of opportunities that you see and you can get, you know. So exclusivity for me is like an old school thing that should go away, you know.
Okay, so we got rid of exclusivity, we got rid of territories. What's going to happen to the PROs?
So the PROs, great question. the difference with PROs, I guess, is that it's kind of legislated. It's part of a legislation and an operation that's happening. And what you see happening, and it's all very new news, it's very interesting because it's kind of happening as we speak. The MLC in the US was just established basically under a new US law. It's the first time that they renewed the copyright law in the US since the days of sheet music. So if you think about it, to see how much the change is huge, you know, music copyright used to work under sheet music copyrights until recently, until 2 years ago. And only now they said, okay, the change is so big, we have to kind of renew the way we structure it. I think PROs are going to be forced, if you want me my kind of forecast on what's going to happen, they're going to be forced to be fully digital, fully clear. Data clarity should be 200% for the creators. I think a lot of old school paradigmas and methods are going to totally break when it comes to PROs. Some of them are actually already doing it, you know, definitely the Scandinavians one especially. And I think most PROs will follow. I definitely think they should stay part of this ecosystem. It's very important that you have societies that takes care of creators, of music creators, but they also need to change their model, I think.
Well, you were talking about that you're thinking or planning to pay out monthly to your artist.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the PRO, it takes them a year before they can pay anything, and you don't even know whether it's correct.
So let me tell you a story. I have a good friend here in Israel called Bruno. He has an interesting company called Revelator. And actually, in the past month, you see a lot of new startups coming in with the same idea he has for a few years already. And he already established what he calls Original Works, which is a digital wallet for royalties and for artists. And he already did like a POC, a proof of concept, with the, I think it's the Danish Collecting Society, TSO, and BMAT, which is a monitoring service. And they actually had three songs monitored in real time, and they paid the creators when the song was aired. They already got credited on their wallet, and that's where it's going. It's going to immediate payments, not only monthly payments. It's going to real time. And I think if you look on the kind of unicorn companies, so Spotify opened Spotify for artists for a reason. They want the artists to be able to see their data, you know. And of course, data is a very, very big player in this new game because it's all about the information that you can collect in real time and the way you connect it on all ends, you know? So I think that's where it should go, definitely where it should go to. Also because if musicians get paid immediately, they can act immediately. You know, the world is so fast. If somebody has a successful song and he has to wait a year to get the money, by the time he gets the money, he has nowhere to invest it because the wave is gone. You know, most success waves today could be a week, 10 days, you know, so it's very, very short. It's not, again, it's a lot of content, so it keeps rolling. It used to be you release a record, you could talk about it for half a year, you know. It's not like that anymore in most cases. Of course, there are a few specific Billie Eilish stories where you talk about it for 2 years, but it's very specific, you know. And very rare.
Interesting. Ori, I raised earlier the question of AI. How do you see that playing out?
It's the golden question when it comes to us. First of all, we are using a lot of AI to do a lot of work behind the scene. We actually just established an AI department also for Artlist. And I think AI tools for sure are going to be more and more integral part of everything you see in digital. I'm guessing you're asking about music created by AI, right?
Well, I think if you'd asked me that question a year ago when we started the podcast, yes. But having had talked to some really quite serious people, the kind of best comment I heard was, everything in our lives will be to do with AI. So
it's almost like that already. You know?
So I think the idea of automatically writing music is obviously one part of it, but I don't see that necessarily as the major part. No, I would say more to do with metadata and background mm-hmm. systems and things. But
So for that, it's already happening in so many places. I mean, AI is used in many, many behind the scenes kind of technologies that are used for many applications and many stuff that are related. I also think that there is going to be a barrier. I don't believe that AI is going to create music the same way people can create music. I'm hoping I'm right. I might be wrong. What I think could be a breakthrough is when AI would become so cool and smart that people can use it to create futuristic sounds, futuristic tracks, you know? And I think it's going to be like a tipping point where, you know, there's probably going to be a lot of companies, there are already, trying to make AI music. But I think then it's going to be more about how you create AI tools for music creation, which you can also already start seeing. It's pretty basic. And I think it's probably also going to break through in a few years. And then we're going to see like also probably a new style of music emerging from it.
Ori, so if you were to give some advice to somebody who's just starting in the business and they're interested in writing, that perhaps they're a good writer, but they don't know how to get their music out there, what sort of advice would you give?
It's a question that I'm always being asked in every interview or podcast.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And it's the hardest one to answer, to be honest. but I think I always say two things, and I think it's always the right one at once at the end. First of all, you need to work at it. You know, you need to consider it as your job. First of all, wake up every day and work, and it's going to take time no matter what you do and how good you are. First of all, because I think a lot of new age musicians or young musicians are, you know, eager to make it happen fast, like everything is happening fast. But it's always going to be a lot of work, you know. And the other is keep a very, very open mind on all aspects, you know, and be open mind on the business side, open mind on the musical side, and try to grasp opportunities as they come in, and not, you know, don't be too stiff or romanticize too much about how it should be or how it should be released. And I think while you should definitely aim for the best quality, you should also kind of understand that everything is faster. So if you can release a lot of good music, it's better than releasing one track of good music over a year. So if you get into this flow where you can work and release and work and release and create and release, it's probably the best way to go. And I think the most successful artists today are releasing music very seamlessly. You know, it's like on a few month basis normally. And it's less album oriented. It's of course more song oriented. So yeah, I think those are the advices I can give. And it's a tough world out there for sure. And I think maybe the other third advice is that you should be the most knowledgeable and professional you can about everything that surrounds the music itself, because it's all do-it-yourself today. And I mean, you would only reach a position where you get a lot of help if you make it on your own. There's no other real way today, I think. It's very rare for somebody to be picked up just because he has talent, you know?
Another hot topic on our side of the industry is the valuation of companies. We all read last week that Epidemic Sound was $1.2 billion dollars. Mm-hmm. First question, are you jealous?
No, I'm happy about it. And for them, I actually visited their offices 2 years ago. And for us, I mean, first of all, we like competition. We think it's great. Also, to answer your previous question, I think it's part of an industry, you know. If we were there alone, it's not a good sign. And I think a good evaluation for a company like Epidemic means a good thing for us as well. we're like younger, I think 5 or 6, 7 years younger than Epidemic, and we're not that far behind in many aspects, I think. I think that the valuation comes mainly from the fact that people see a big future for this new model of music licensing, you know, because it's not fully based on actual current numbers. It's more about the future.
Yeah, because I read on a Facebook group, people were laughing about the valuation of Epidemic and saying, well, if I look at my catalog should be worth $5 million. Of course, that catalog isn't worth $5 million. But what's the difference between that catalog and Epidemic then?
Again, the thing with Epidemic or with Artlist and these companies, it's not just the catalog, it's the full product, you know, and that's the big difference. On the other hand, you can also see, of course, companies like Hypnosis Songs, which I'm hoping and guessing you know about, which created a new age or model for music publishing, where they actually kind of use it as commercial assets, you know, as something that's tradable. And, you know, Hypnosis makes huge deals on songs and intellectual property. And in the recent month, you also hear a lot about NFTs, if you heard about it, which is unique digital art that you can buy. It's not just music, it's just starting to go into music as well. So there's a lot of new avenues. And again, if you look at it at the end, the medium keeps changing, but the actual thing doesn't, you know? So it's just a matter of how you kind of shift through. So, you know, who would have thought that somebody would pay $1 million for a digital GIF? And it just happened last week a few times, you know, because an art collector decided he wants that NFT of a specific, you know, truly owned original digital painting, basically. It's something that, you know, could be unbelievable if you had told it to me a few years ago. But today, what I think you see is you see old models going into new models, but it's still the same concept. And I think maybe I drifted away from your question a little bit. But I think, I think those evaluations understand that there's a lot of places to develop. And it's just not just the catalog, it's the vision, it's the business vision, the software vision, like how you're going to develop your tools, how you're going to use AI in the background of it to make better tools for people. And also because they see that the content world is expanding in all dimensions of it. So there's going to be more customers as well, you know.
So should we look at music more as a commodity than as an art form?
Absolutely not. It was always also a commodity, except, I mean, you know, it's a tough definition, but it's a commodity of an art form. That's what it always was. Again, I think, you know, it used to be more romantic before, where you could create a record and then release it, and then the label would collect the money, and the artist was on one side and the business was on the other. And that's kind of what changed. But it's still, again, it's all the same thing. I mean, people were always making music to make money as well. It never changed, you know, because you need, I mean, unless the whole capitalistic system crashes and you don't need to make money anymore, which might happen one day as well, then you need to make money if you want to make a living, you know, so you can't avoid it.
So, Ori, just if you're a British broadcaster, say at the BBC, and you want to use some music, you'll typically go on their website, and the first choice you make is commercial music or production music. And if you go to commercial music, you're going to have to make separate deals with different people. It's going to be quite expensive. So if you use production music, it's more simple, and it's there because initially it was there because it was designed to compete with or to provide people with an alternative to expensive commercial music. It seems to me what you've done is completely washed away those distinctions.
Absolutely.
I mean, I have to say it's a really good thing, I think. So if you look at traditional record companies who are still licensing their expensive copyrights that they've built up over the last 40 years, would you advise them to take a more radical view on their copyrights and sort of, rather than protect them, get them out there and get them used?
My personal advice, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I would say do that, and definitely do that with things that are sitting there, like on the shelf, you know, because it can, you see it happening. I mean, I'm guessing you know about what happened with the Fleetwood Mac song on TikTok. You know, it came out of nowhere and became huge again just because it was used on UJC platforms. Like, people reposted it. It's all about reposting. I think it's very similar, you know, like about 15 years ago, mashups and remixes used to be like, what's going on? Why are people mixing stuff together and all that? And now it's like an obvious part of the art form. So it's kind of the same, like, you know, making music available for syncing to other content is natural today. It's part of what it is.
Yeah. So as a follow-up to that, Ori, if an artist came to you with an album of cover versions, can you cope with that within your structure, or is that a kind of big no-no for you?
Only if we have permission from the original copyright owner, of course. I mean, so that won't change.
And have you done that yet? Is that something you've brokered yet, or no?
No, because it's. But to be honest, only because it's complicated. More on the. It's definitely possible on the legal or licensing part. It's harder on the digital part because all the platforms like YouTube and so on. Only YouTube has a real operating system today for matching and kind of, you know, finding the copyrights out there. Yeah. And all the others don't, or it's half working, and it's going to change too as well, probably in the next year or two. But it makes it hard to control licenses for music that you can't clear on your own, you know, so that's a little difficult.
So just clarify for me, so if somebody gives you a piece of music, but they also give it to someone else, does your watermarking system allow you to distinguish between it when it's used on YouTube, say, between your version that you've released and their version that they've given to another platform?
Yeah, we have solutions for that.
You do? Yeah. Yeah. Otherwise, it'd be difficult, wouldn't it?
Of course. It's still, yeah. I mean, it's an ongoing challenge, to be honest, because the technologies keep changing. And again, only YouTube has an actual system that actually works at the moment. And that also keeps changing, and it's also very limited the way they built it. And of course, it's understood because it's so much of data and information they need to analyze. It has to be very strict. But I think that's also going to develop a lot, and you see a lot more options for co-publishing on digital audio fingerprinting systems. You know, so. I mean, I'm also assuming, also when I told you about Bruno and the smart wallet and all that, that's what it's about. It's about being able to, you know, have various amount of copyright holders for the same asset and let it go free in the digital jungle and make sure that everybody gets their share. That's what it's all about. And I think cryptocurrency or blockchain technology is very important for that.
Yeah.
Final question for you, because we're almost an hour in a nice conversation with you.
Yeah. Thank you.
In 5 years' time, where's Artlist, and where are the traditional production music libraries?
Wow. 5 years is very long when we talk about.
Okay, 2 years. 2 years.
2 years. Where is the traditional library music?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a great question. I'm scared to say something that would be held against me, but I think. The way I see, what I see from the inside, Artlist is going in an amazing direction towards that future. And I think it's going to be all about, you know, software as a service, like making the best quality in everything, the assets, the way it's, you know, being delivered to the customers, and covering all new asset types, which I think is also going to evolve very fast. So I think only the companies that will be very, you know, with hard, how would you say in English, you know, close to the heartbeat and feeling the actual, what's really going on and acting really fast and changing fast, they would keep going for sure. And those who won't, I'm not sure, because again, those big libraries have pretty big companies behind them, so they might just kind of fold back into something, I don't know. But I'm guessing you're going to see them mainly, if they're not going to change, they're going to disappear. I guess that's my answer, because it's all about changing fast.
Yeah,
we need to get out of our asses. That's basically what you're saying.
I don't know where you are, but yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Ori. It was wonderful talking to you.
Same
had a great
here.
Time, and hope to see you soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Cheers, Ori. Thank you. Very interesting. Thank you.